This is CNY Speaks, the new public affairs program from WAER that tackles the issues that matter to you about Central New York. And in this program, we're going to try and bring the Interstate 81 replacement project up to date, including ways the public can still have a voice, and examine some of the perhaps lesser known possible impacts of the project going forward. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Chris Bolt, WAER News and Public Affairs Director. Announcer and reporter Katie Zilkowski is with me for our discussion, and we're joined by Jonathan Link Logan, Director of Northside Up, a program of Center State CEO. Jonathan lives on the North Side and has been part of the program for 10 years. He also has a background in urban and regional planning, as well as landscape architecture. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Ann Mosher, Chair of the Maxwell Citizenship and Civic Engagement Program and Associate Professor of Geography at Syracuse University. Her teaching and research has covered urban planning and infrastructure, as well as civic engagement, especially as it relates to certain aspects of New York State. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we have Yusuf Abdul-Kadir, who directs the local chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union here in Central New York. He's concerned with the impacts of human behavior on the natural environment and communities. He's also worked on minimizing the trade-offs of sustainable development while identifying opportunities to reinvest in natural and human capital. And welcome to you.
Thank you.
All right. Of course, I-81 has been the topic of much debate, numerous public meetings and events, studies, and no shortage of opinions and posturing about how the replacement of the elevated portion through Syracuse will affect us. We will not in this program stage another debate over the various proposals, options to replace the stretch of highway. What we will do is try to dig a little deeper into the complicated process, which includes first a draft EIS, then a final EIS, public comment periods, approvals at various levels, then debates over funding, whichever plan is selected. We also want to shed some more light on how you can influence that process and just who else has a say and some sway in that final decision. Finally, rather than debate replacing the viaduct versus a community grid and whether a tunnel fits into the plans, we're going to try to talk about some of the considerations that should be on the list of concerns over and above simply traffic patterns and schedules for demolition and construction. So let's get a start with bringing the project up to date. We're anticipating the release of the draft environmental impact statement any day now. What all is considered in what I understand is a huge document? Jonathan, maybe we'll start with you. What's in that huge study?
So in addition to just the regular looking at what the transportation infrastructure would be, they also look into the social impacts, the environmental impacts, economic impacts, things that are, you know, part of a larger piece of this puzzle that's just not just transportation.
And the study is so many pages. Who figures out what goes in there and how do they assess? I mean, the traffic seems like the most interesting or easy one. Some of these other things seem like it's a lot more difficult to sort of quantify what those impacts might be. Anne, do you know about that?
So generally, the state is in charge of this process, but there are a lot of different stakeholders who are brought on board. And so there are other government agencies and their data collections that are brought to bear on this. But in general, the document, which they can run between 700 and 1,200 pages long. They're huge. Generally, they start out talking about the project. Then there will be a discussion about the various alternatives that have been on the table. After that, there's a long look at a whole list of environmental variables that will come into play, like how much land will need to be acquired, what cultural resources might be threatened, what impact might there be on air quality, noise abatement. And then there's a discussion about construction effects, what will actually go on during the time when, you know, the shovels are working. And then what are the indirect effects and the cumulative impacts? And that leads usually into a discussion about environmental justice, which is something that has been required since 1994, a governor's executive order. And so that's a very interesting part of these documents generally and really reflects a lot about community values.
And that's really where we do start to get into the concern about things other than just the traffic pattern what exactly the roadway will look like or run through, et cetera, but the broader impacts. As this thing comes out, and as I said, we're anticipating it in the not too distant future. It's been promised a couple times along the line, but it is imminent in the next, I don't know, what would we say, weeks or months anyway. Once it comes out, what should people look for? There's a lot of concerned public on this issue. What should people look at that document to see that they might want to comment about and maybe have some influence on?
You know, if I could jump in, I would add to what Ann said about the need for a kind of rigorous approach to identifying the environmental justice aspects of the issues, and particularly as it relates to cumulative effects. We know this, but I just want to sometimes make it clear for the public that we have the ninth most segregated county in the country, and we have the most segregated school boarders within a county in the entire state of New York. And we do know that the highway is a significant driver of those realities. And so when we think about cumulative effects, and when we assess from a technical perspective the respective options that are on the table, whether and we won't get into the debates about those options. But when you do a deep dive into an analysis of those options, what we need to begin to think about in the comment period are what are the adverse effects of each of these options? When you think about what the Centers for Disease Control at the national level says about residential proximity to highways and what that means for your health, your ability to have clean air. When you think about the effects and impacts of opportunities to be able to live in communities that are thriving, when you think about the chances to be able to go to schools that are funded equitably, these are the types of considerations that a lot of folks don't think about and think through and don't have a really strong appreciation for what the highway as it currently exists has done to kind of create those realities. And so thinking through how are we going to reimagine our connection amongst and with each other and the responsibilities that we have to use this as a time to begin to mitigate those issues?
So this document is, as you say, going to be huge, and that can be daunting for an everyday person who doesn't typically read transportation studies that are 1,200 pages. And these effects are, they make great impacts on our community. So what are some tips for someone who wants to digest this information, who wants to really learn about this process, to approach this document, to get involved, and to make sure their voice is heard and they're taking in the information that they need?
Yeah. So for our part, the NYCLU is engaging and has been engaging a wide swath of stakeholders, from engineers and architects, city planners, community activists. I mean, we've been doing a really comprehensive, along with a lot of other groups who've been doing this work before us, to try to identify how do we not just touch people and get them to understand what a Department of Transportation is, mm-hmm. right? Let alone what the draft environmental impact statement is and what it will have, what impacts it will have on their lives. And so before it's come out and during the time that it will be released, the DEIS I'm referring to, we've been engaging people to just get them to understand what the highway currently is doing and how it currently interacts with their lives, help them go through and walk through the various options so they can begin to make informed decisions about what options are best for them, and then help them advocate by way of helping them draft their comments and helping them get to the comment period. It's really essential that the community has the communities, and I do, in particular in this moment when I say community, those who live directly abutting the highway, whether they're in Syracuse Housing Authority or the private homeowners or the renters who live next to the highway who've existed there for a long time. It's important for us to really make sure that their voices are elevated in this conversation. And so our work and the work of many others has been to take the experts, the engineers, the architects, other folks who have this expertise, create a brain trust, if you will, kind of a community think tank to be able to help the community understand the magnitude of this issue and break it down in a way that's palatable and really comprehensive. For them to be able to begin to engage in the process and demonstrate to them that this is probably, if not the most important issue that we will be advocating on in this community.
As you mentioned, the comment period, and so that will be after the DEIS comes out. And then after that, what does the time frame look like? Is this going to be something that takes another, we talked about this going on from 2006 on. Is this going to take another 10 years? Is this going to happen in a number of months? So what happens after that?
So once this drops, there will be, within the next 15 days, a public hearing. And when that public hearing occurs, then there'll be at least 45 days of public comment. And it's unclear if that 45 days is completely time limited or if that's something that can be extended. I think it all depends on how much people in the community get involved and the kinds of concerns that they raise, because the state is obligated to listen to all comment. So after that, it goes down into creating a final environmental impact statement, FEIS, and that will then become the basis for making the final decision. And there really is no way to predict how long this will take, because when you look at other projects around New York State, sometimes this goes very quickly. Other times it can be bogged down. So who knows?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that when the draft scoping report was out, they extended that 45-day comment period to, I think it was around 75 days or a little, it was definitely longer. And then they took all of the comments that they received, which were thousands of them, and compacted them into like questions, so that your answer wasn't, or your question wasn't necessarily definitively answered, but it was put into a group of others. And so that takes a bunch of time for them to do that. And then to Anne's point, you know, after that, we really don't know.
We do know that DOT has expressed that they believe there's a necessity to extend the process with respect to the comment period, which is really important and key, because that, again, is our opportunity to really have a robust discussion.
What are you guys going to be looking, Anne and Jonathan, when that thing comes out? What would you be looking for as somebody who's been, you know, interested in this process? Jonathan, I know you've been involved in it in various discussions internally and externally.
Yeah, so I think that I'm interested in not just the transportation component of this, but the economic impacts, the environmental justice impacts, the impacts of construction, because I think that, you know, we've seen a lot of discussion about, you know, how long is it going to take for this thing to be actually implemented?
Right.
And there's going to be, during that time frame, a lot of impacts on the community that are going to be in some respects above and beyond what they will, the community will see once the thing is built, because once it's built, it's operational, right? But while you're building it, there's going to be a lot of, you know, impacts on people's lives, whether that's folks who are living literally right next door to the highway or those who are trying to get in and out of our community for their jobs.
I think I'll be most interested in looking at the data and seeing where that came from. So what is the state marshaling as evidence? Secondly, I'm going to be very interested in the section that looks at indirect effects and cumulative impacts to see how this is being presented historically. And I think also the environmental justice piece as well. Those are the pieces that I'll be focusing on.
And once we get to the final EIS, which is, as you said, the draft will be dropped, there'll be probably an extended comment period, then they'll come up with a final report, which might be months later. That's actually the document that a decision is made upon. So once that gets out there, does everybody kind of agree that that covers as many things as we could have put in there, given that the process has gone on so long? Or is that still even a controversial document?
As I understand it, there's still...
Because some people are not going to like stuff that's in there.
Of course, right? And people will do what they will do. And we can't necessarily... We can really probably forecast what that might look like. But as it relates to the process, there's still an opportunity to mitigate. And I think that's an important component as well. Mm-hmm. The mitigation of the decisions and even the final actual construction plan can change in some respects and can become – it's relatively malleable in that it's reflective of what – they're not going to go from a community grid to a tunnel, right, if the final EIS suggests one should be done. But what the community grid or what a tunnel option or what another viaduct would look like specifically and which are the roadways that it will take, those issues will have to be addressed in mitigation and moving beyond the final EIS and after having gone through the questioning process and period. And so it's important for the public to still be engaged and involved, because it's necessary for us to get it right.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that in our next segment. This is CNY Speaks, the new public affairs program from WAER, connecting you to the issues that matter in Central New York. When we come back, we want to talk about input and influence. Who has a say in what will be a Department of Transportation decision, and how can you still get in your two cents worth? Thanks for listening.
On-demand audio on WAER is supported by SRC Incorporated, headquartered in Syracuse, New York. SRC is actively hiring engineers and other positions. Learn more at srcinc.com/careers.
I think that, you know, a good portion of the rest of the community or the city looked at that as an opportunity to make more money for the city and to eliminate, you know, from a racial perspective, for those who were using that as the impetus to break up, you know, a concentration of people of color.
And you've just been hearing what was a brief segment of past reporting we did on WAER's City Limits Project on poverty. You can hear more at the special website citylimitsproject.org. Welcome back. This is CNY Speaks, the new public affairs program from WAER that tackles issues that matter to you about Central New York. We're discussing the process of deciding just what's next for the crumbling elevated portion of I-81, and now we want to discuss something about the influence. Let's start with civic leaders. Many have come out in favor of one plan or another. Others have suggested things that should get included in the project, different community groups, etc. Who has the ear of those who will be making the decisions on one of the specific options eventually and all the other details, such as cost and timelines, et cetera?
So it's important for us to step back just a little bit to understand that the technical analysis is what guides the decision-making process, and that the technical analysis, though this is also a very highly political process, is what should be what we are determining how we decide on which options are done. There has been a really large political campaign, and mm-hmm. as a person who used to work in politics, it's really interesting to see the types of ways and strategies with which people are leveraging the process to have influence on the process. But inevitably, the Department of Transportation makes the decision. If there is a stakeholder who has the most amount of sway or power over that, would be the governor's office, because it's his executive agency. And so it's important for people to begin to stress the necessity to engage robustly with the not just the Department of Transportation, their elected officials at the state level, as well as the governor's office, because really it is an executive office, and that executive office has a significant amount of power. There are also additional agencies outside in the federal administration, so from the federal Department of Transportation and the federal Highway Administration, who also have intersecting responsibilities with respect to this, but the lead agency is the New York State Department of Transportation.
Because one of the things that I've seen is that the public wants, whether it's the mayor or the county executive or their particular councilor or legislator or state representative, the public wants those people who hold those offices to have an opinion, to make it known, to feel like they're the conduit to the process. Jonathan, you and I were talking a little bit about how the State Department of Transportation probably wants a decision that local officials support, even though there's no obviously local consensus.
Yeah, I think that the DOT, as they have worked through this process and have engaged different folks in the community, you know, they want to be supportive of what I think that folks feel is the best for the community, and I think that that's important to understand that while it's the community of Central New York and the entire region, that there are certain parts of the community that have more impacts than others, and I think that when you look at who they're engaging in the process, that's important to consider.
Especially, I know Anne was going to jump in, but it's important to kind of just stop this discussion about consensus being a driver for how we make a decision, because that's not what the basis of a decision should be made on. And there's a lot of rhetoric around and a lot of talk about the need to build consensus and a need for compromise, et cetera, but that's not how you determine these projects. You determine these projects on the technical analysis. And oftentimes we give the guise of consensus, the guise of compromise, as a means to kind of really get what people want. And it's important that we really center the conversation about what are the actual impacts and how are those impacts going to implicate not just the region broadly, though people in Oswego have a say because they live and thrive off of it. The people who literally live in proximity to the highway have to be weighted more heavily because of the types of impacts. And when you begin to have that kind of conversation, you illuminate and elevate the discussion about how are we going to ensure that the region as a whole can thrive.
Mm-hmm. How do we get, again, whether it's a politician saying a specific part or a reason or concern about some impact, how do we get people in general to consider all of the impacts rather than one very narrow one? I mean, Anne, you've studied civic engagement. Where are the intersections between really broadening issues out like this, as you're saying, Yusuf, to really get everything that's in there technically to be considered, not just one or another factor that might be sort of cherry-picked out right. of the EIS to say something, but really to consider all the impacts and somebody in DeWitt being concerned with the people who live next to the highway, somebody in Oswego having some sense of what it means to the downtown Syracuse landscape.
Yeah, I think this is a really challenging question because infrastructure is a really bizarre thing. I mean, on the one hand, it's rooted in a particular location, but on the other hand, it gives off these externality effects that we all end up having a stake in. So we almost need to get up to 32,000 feet and look down on central New York and try to see this thing synoptically, try to see it comprehensively. And I think what really complicates this issue is that we have such a strong sense because of home rule in New York State of jurisdictionality, but at the same time grafted on top of those jurisdictions, which are all really different and they all want their own local autonomy. We've got this ecosystem that is interconnected and everybody is interdependent. And so it's really sometimes very difficult to kind of separate out those local, parochial, self-interested values that mm-hmm. a particular jurisdiction might have from the collective sense of the whole. And, you know, if you've got a part of the ecosystem that is really struggling, that has ripple effects throughout the entire local economy, through the environment. And so, like I said, infrastructure is a really difficult thing because not only is it rooted in those jurisdictions, it's the thing that creates the connections within that ecosystem.
I just wanted to add, I think that another important component of helping people is to do what Yusuf was talking about earlier, and that's like get out into the community and engage folks and help educate people about this, because there are people who are only going to compare or care about their commute time or something else. But I think that there is a swath of the population who wants to learn more about this important decision and understand the nuances and continue to educate themselves and be informed so that when the DEIS drops that they can begin to engage in that process perhaps more than they have already, because I think we talked at the beginning that this conversation has been going on for a really long time. And there are people who just, you know, their eyes glaze over and just say, let's make right. a decision. But there are still people out there who I think really want to know about this.
And actually, when we have done this, and I think it's important to take for folks to take away the necessity for myth busting and really elevating the conversations. And I'm going to keep using that phrase because the conversations, and I've been involved in this conversation almost ad nausea every day of
sure.
my life. Like I was in Mexico last week, and even in Mexico, I'm like talking about 81, right? And so, you know, I think it's essential that not only we elevate the conversation so that we can get at some of these concerns and issues, but so that when we do the process of connecting with folks, you allay some of the concerns that they have about, well, my voice really doesn't matter, right? You know, I cared about Kennedy Square a decade ago, and it didn't matter. And 2 weeks before, folks had to go. These are the kinds of issues that we're facing in the community. My voice didn't matter 50 years ago when the community was destroyed to make the highway so that people can have this 5-minute convenience. And when you begin to engage folks and you have a conversation and you make it simple and you walk them through the process, they then understand why this issue matters, how it directly or perhaps indirectly impacts them, and now they're charged and motivated to be involved. And busting the myths and giving facts and having actual information that's based on data that is real from the Department of Transportation has been invaluable in us doing that.
So there sounds like there can be a lot of clutter and a lot of things going on at one time surrounding the 81 debate. And so there's probably risk for confusion. In what ways are people trying to combat that and be proper civically engaged citizens so that they understand that their voice can have a say and they're also getting information from the DOT and not just random information?
Yeah, so we've, and I don't want to add another monkey wrench to the equation, but there are so many things that are happening and our bandwidths are so small. Our lives have become so inundated with information all the time from everywhere and every source. It is difficult for folks to kind of just sit back and assess what's the real information, what's the persuasive information that folks are trying to persuade you to believe, and what is actually the heart of how this is going to impact you. And so what I often do and what the NYCLU often does is try to separate issues for people. So there's obviously a conversation about Blueprint 15, Syracuse Surge, 81, and we say these are all important conversations, but there are three sets of trains on three different tracks. And right now, the 81 track is about to depart, and it's 10:37 is the time. It's 10:37, and the train leaves at 11. And we can worry about the 3 p.m. Blueprint 15 train when we get to 3 p.m., but we've got to have the conversations about the 81 discussion while we have an opportunity. Otherwise, the train will leave. And when we created that sense of urgency, again, we've noticed that people began to separate what are the myths from how Blueprint 15 may or may not interact versus what do they need to do to engage in the 81 process so that we can have a better outcome in that process. And I think it's necessary for advocates and people who are responsible, including elected officials, to do that work. It is essential that you inform your public because inevitably we have a responsibility. And if we don't address this issue, if we don't mitigate the hypersegregation, if we don't mitigate these school funding inequities, if we don't address these concerns, it doesn't matter what option we take because we will be in the same condition. And you cannot have a thriving Central New York if the city of Syracuse isn't thriving. And the reasons why the city of Syracuse isn't thriving is because of the highest rates of concentrated poverty, the 9th most segregated county in the country, a underfunded school system that New York State Supreme Court says is unconstitutional, and the fact that we are not engaging folks in a robust way to understand what is the role that the highway has played and is currently playing in creating that reality.
So has there been enough urgency? Do you guys think that there has been enough urgency around this conversation that's been going on for now over 10 years?
Well, I think it depends on where you are. I think that there's been a lot of urgency in, let's say, the University Hill area. I think there's been urgency in the areas that depend on 81 for commuting. But I think there's a lot of Central New York where, well, I don't use that piece of interstate that much, so I really don't care. I think it depends on where you are. And so I think that the landscape of concern and knowledge is highly variable.
Is there a way to get people to respect all of the impacts? As we've said, people have their self-interest. You are interested in something that's closer to you. That's just natural. That's never going to change. Though, are there ways or have there been efforts to, or should there be more efforts to, open up the eyes of, Yusuf, what you were just saying, or Jonathan, what we were talking about how the decision on this issue will affect transportation, mass transit, it'll affect health and the environment. And for someone who has one narrow concern, can they be made to see the larger concerns of the whole area?
That's a really good question. I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know.
You haven't figured that all out?
No. I think, you know, my personal bias is that, you know, as a urban and regional planner or someone with that background, I would hope that people would want to see the bigger picture and understand how all of this stuff fits together. But I also feel that there's a degree of self-interest that folks have that they just care about their one piece and everything else perhaps doesn't necessarily matter. And I know that might sound a little bit cold, but you know,
that's just the facts.
The overarching discussion that we've seen in the community seems to lead me to believe that might just be the way where it's going to go.
Though there certainly become issues that people do kind of engage on. Anne Mosher, I know you've studied a little bit about social media and you know, public platforms for consumer information, mm-hmm. or consumer-generated information, people do get involved in some things. You know, are there ways, do you think, on this issue to elucidate some of the different things that, that actually do concern you? They're just not the immediate, the travel time or the, you know, what's going to happen in your neighborhood if there's more traffic on 481, for example, or how the north side is or isn't accessed by a specific, you know, traffic pattern.
There may be ways to leverage some of the Facebook groups. I'm thinking specifically about some of the nostalgia Facebook groups in Syracuse that have a really interesting, I wouldn't call it a political debate, but a real interesting debate about the meaning of the past. Mm-hmm. And there may be ways to sort of insert this topic into that particular conversation and relate it back to some of the things that people do care about in terms of this region's history and heritage, like the Erie Canal or the New York Central Railroad. This is just another chapter in that transportation history. And it turns out that a lot of people have strong opinions about that, or it's all sort of connected into their mental map of the area. And so there may be some opportunities there to get people thinking, like I said, more synoptically and comprehensively about the issue through things that they care about. And people do care about their past experiences, their childhood, their growing up, remembering what Syracuse was like before. And if you look at some of the renderings that have been done for some of the different options, there are some really compelling visions of a Syracuse that could be in the future that sort of harkens back to some of the things that people thought Syracuse was like in the past. Hmm. So this could be, I think, a really cool opportunity to think about what's going on right here and right now in terms of what went on before, how that informed what we've got today, and where do we want to be in the future.
It's so important that you said, you know, how the past has gotten us to where we are today. And this is a really difficult conversation to have because I don't think, and I'm gonna challenge us in this discussion to have that conversation, or at least a part of it. We don't appreciate or don't oftentimes get the relationship between wanting to maintain segregation and what that has had by way of developing suburbia. And I think it's difficult for us to get it because we have such a contrasting understanding of what segregation meant. It only, for a lot of people, the images that we see of segregation are black, white, colored white, right? And so that's not what existed in the North, right? It didn't say literally blacks only, whites only, but the ways in which we developed communities after Brown has come down as saying that this is unconstitutional segregation in schools.
Brown versus the Board of Education.
Brown versus the Board of Education, landmark Supreme Court case, has been leveraging and utilizing urban sprawl or suburb or the development of the suburbs as a means to ensure that you can have de facto segregation. And so it's important for us to think about the nostalgia that we have, the images that we want to harken back to, how has that created where we are today, but probably more importantly, how do we have honest conversations about where we need to go together moving forward?
Do you guys think there is a way to have those honest conversations with community members? I mean, you mentioned that it is hard, and I think for a lot of people it is looking themselves in the mirror and saying there's an issue. But how do you have that conversation without people getting defensive and just saying you're picking on me or something? And that
you sense? Have it.
Yeah.
You have it, right? It's going to be tough. People are going to and actually we do know that when we've had it, when we've gotten to the brass tacks, and I don't really know what that phrase means, but when we got into the core of the conversations, we do know that people have been swayed to say, listen, I now understand this profoundly. When we can talk about the fact of what the CDC says about residential proximity to highway and that literally you live less because you live next to a highway. I mean, that's huge. And then you either have to sit and say to yourself, I'm okay with people and children dying earlier and people and elderly people having COPD and bronchitis and asthma issues and cardiovascular diseases, all of which are captured in the CDC report. I'm okay with that as long as it means I can get in and out of Syracuse for 5 minutes.
I think that's really the issue. Is this a problem associated with efficiency or is this a social justice issue? I think that's really what this, in the end, comes down to.
Yeah, and in our next segment, we're going to discuss a little bit about what some of these other issues are, so we will expand on this discussion. This is CNY Speaks, the new public affairs program from WAER, connecting you to the issues that matter to Central New York. When we come back, what is really at stake with the possible changing of I-81, past traffic patterns and construction? How much can we or should we be considering public health, mass transit, and other factors? Thanks for joining us.
Stop for a moment and ask yourself a question. Where do you turn for extended coverage of the issues that matter to you? If you answered that question, WAER, then doesn't it make sense to financially support your source for local news coverage? When major stories shake our community, we're there to keep you well-informed and up-to-date. Your financial support helps to keep us on the scene when news happens. Keep this news coverage going strong with your gift today. Give online at WAER.org.
Think that, you know, a good portion of the rest of the community of the city looked at that as an opportunity to make more money for the city and to eliminate, you know, from a racial perspective, for those who were using that as the impetus to break up, you know, a concentration of people of color.
And you were just hearing a brief segment of past reporting we did on WAER's City Limits Project on poverty about the 81 issue. Hear more at citylimitsproject.org. And thanks for being with us. Welcome back. This is CNY Speaks, our new public affairs program from WAER that tackles issues that matter to you about Central New York. We're discussing the process of deciding on the future of the elevated portion of I-81 and all of the issues that might be impacted. I'm Chris Bolt, along with WAER's Katie Zilkowski, and we're joined by Dr. Ann Mosher, chair of the Maxwell Citizenship and Civic Engagement Program. Yusuf Abdul-Kadir is Central New York Chapter Director of the NYCLU, and Jonathan Link Logan, director of Northside Up, a program of Center State CEO.
And we've been having some pretty good conversations here over the break, and we'd love to bring them to you now on this show. So, Anne, could you tell us a little bit about the political context that 81 was built under in the 1950s and 60s?
Sure. So discussions about an arterial expressway really started in Syracuse during the 1930s and 1940s. And this was in response to things that were going on all over the country, and particularly in New York State. New York State was a leader in the creator of expressways. And so there was a lot of debate about what the benefits of creating these expressways might be. There was a concern for making sure that cities were connected into this emerging network of cities. There was a desire to rationalize industry and get it out of inner city locations and out to more suburban areas so there could be sort of a larger factory footprint. You know, there were all sorts of, I guess, very modernist ideas about what cities should be like. And when it came down to Syracuse, really what the concern was to make sure that there was a great north-south and east-west set of arterials. And so in the 1950s, of course, New York State undertook its massive thruway construction process. And so that was how we got our east-west arterial, which, by the way, went north of the city. But there was thinking that was emerging during the 1940s and 1950s that these interstates or these expressways should run through the heart of cities. And so if you go back and look at some of the histories that have been done, and if you look at the primary record, it's very complicated. There is no one storyline. And at times you've got the urban downtown elite in Syracuse arguing for an expressway, and other times arguing against it. And when it came to I-81 in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the top concern of Syracuse's civic leaders was to make certain that the interstate highway that would be constructed would run close to the city of Syracuse. The initial maps actually had what became 81 running somewhere over close to Canastota, in between Utica and the city of Syracuse. So over time, not sure what the politics were, but that that alignment was brought closer to the city of Syracuse. Then, once it was decided that it was going to run through the city of Syracuse, that became a state issue, and the state was in charge of making the decisions. And they were based mainly on where the state was able to acquire property cheaply or where they already had property. And so this particular project became wrapped up with a civic renewal project for the city of Syracuse that also, by the way, led to the demolition of the 15th Ward to create the Hutchings Psychiatric Hospital campus, but also parts of this new civic center that was being built. So at the time, the civic leaders did not want to see this new expressway, this new interstate, be something that was at grade level, that is at street surface level, or something that would be depressed, because many of them 30 years before were thinking about the way in which the Erie Canal, which was still a part of our urban fabric up until the early 1920s, they thought about how that divided the city. And they believed that this interstate, if it was depressed, would have the same sort of effect. So how does the state respond to that? It responds by giving a viaduct. And the civic leaders respond to that by saying, well, we don't really want that either. And it was likened to the Great Wall of China, potentially.
You know, we were having a really, really robust discussion, right? And I think it's important, and I'm happy that we're kind of having that here and on air, because it's important for the public to both have an understanding and appreciation. And I know that you have a segment on redlining that folks should listen to, but we can't have this discussion about 81 without first understanding redlining and its impacts. And not to reiterate what redlining is, but to give a brief understanding of it, it's banks that are backed by federal government not loaning money to African Americans and other people of color, and determining that neighborhoods are not worthy based on their racial composition to be invested in. And as a result, it creating an incentive for people, a literal financial incentive, to not integrate or live in amongst communities. And this was a policy by the federal government. And it's important for us to say that, for us to own it, and for us to acknowledge that. Because the next iteration of this is urban renewal, right? This definition that there are certain communities that are blighted, and those communities, and you can look at the comments, both in the redlining comments as well as the comments about the communities that were considered quote unquote blighted. They're often communities, and they have been historically communities that were communities of color. And in the case of Syracuse, the 15th Ward, which was originally a Jewish community, that also became a largely African-American community, mostly because if you rented or a person of color moved in or bought a home, it was less likely that anyone else would be able to buy that home. And so therefore, we created these actual divisions that have been the means for when 81 comes down, whose spaces are valuable and whose spaces are not worthy or it's acceptable for us to destroy their homes, whose communities we have respect for and whose communities are negligible. And so when it comes to the case of 81, and for us as the ACLU of New York, the NYCLU, our chapter in Central New York formed in response to people's homes being demolished to create the viaduct. So this is for us very personal, because it's a part of our own history as an organization in this area. And the devastation that it has wrought on this community is the types of things that we see today. And we often have this discussion, and we were having the discussion about 81 not being the only driver.
But an amplifier.
And I am clear often to say it has been a major driver. It's not the only one. But there are things that have been addressed with respect to redlining. It's right not legal to do that anymore. The last barrier that we have to beginning to create a new footprint is this quote-unquote Great Wall of China in Syracuse 81, because it is a physical, emotional barrier that exists in the community. And it's not a magic wand that you move the highway and all of a sudden we're now no longer segregated. But it creates the opportunities for those things to happen, whereas you don't have those opportunities under certain options. And I think when we – and that's why I think this is beyond just a transportation issue, right? And in fact, the Obama administration in their rule of 2015 to affirmatively further fair housing talked about this. They talked about the need for interagency collaboration between the Department of Transportation, the Department of Urban and Housing and Urban Development, HUD, the Department of Education, because we understood the role that highways have played in addition to, you know, urban renewal and in addition to redlining that they've played in creating these hyper-segregated communities and these really areas of inequality and lack of opportunity. And CNY Fair Housing articulates this in their report, and I think it's important for folks to remember that.
Can I jump in for a second?
Yeah,
I also think that there's another component of this. All of the stuff that Yusuf was just talking about is incredibly important. But I think that part of it is, you know, we're looking at DOT and other external agencies as the folks who can help drive this process. And that is true. But I think that there's also an ownership that we as a community need to take on as part of this. And Anne was speaking to this a little bit before about the civic engagement component and using this as an opportunity to kind of, you know, flex our muscles in the world of being more actively engaged in this process. And I think that, you know, we're starting to see some of that happen now. You just, I think it was last week maybe, that the Urban Jobs Task Force dropped their report about how this highway project could or should be creating direct impacts in people's lives by offering opportunities for jobs. And I think that it's important that we recognize that this is coming and that those jobs are going to be there regardless of what opportunity or alternative is chosen, and that we start mobilizing to create opportunities for people to get trained up so that they're ready for when those jobs hit, for MWBE contractors to get all the paperwork in line so that when the contracts start coming, that they're ready to be a part of that process and bid on them rather than getting caught flat-footed and not being able to take advantage of those opportunities.
I think that's a really important point. No matter which option is chosen, there is going to be construction. And that construction does offer opportunities, not just for work, but for job training.
Are there other considerations, just as we have a couple minutes left, that should be out there? I mean, we can't go into them too far. Maybe they're cause for a future show. But are there other considerations that the public might say, this is also an impact of this decision? I mean, so many times we do some major public project, infrastructure project, and it has these unintended consequences. The window washing thing, I thought was a great example. But some are much, much more significant. Now that we've made 81, the community's kind of built around it a little bit. But once we change it in whatever way, what other considerations might there be that people should try to engage in, maybe look at the EIS, environmental impact statements, and see if they're being addressed so that it really can be the best solution for the whole community?
I think we need to become more ambitious in how we think about the opportunity that 81's replacement creates. There's a chance for us to really, and we didn't talk about transportation beyond vehicular transportation, but the Department of Transportation also funds mass transit.
Right.
And so, like, when you have a community that is not engaged in the way of transportation to get to where the employment opportunities outside of the city are because of a lack of transportation infrastructure and because of Central's limitation in routes, we can be having a very robust conversation about how do we get people beyond vehicular transportation, which is also classist, which is also which also in Syracuse has racial implications. For me, I want us to be even bolder, and my organization is engage in this process, not because we see this as the one be-all, end-all solution, but the beginning of a series of solutions that can come afterwards. And so we talked a little bit about the necessity for us to have a conversation about schools. And sometimes it gets really difficult for people to talk about whether or not we should have integrated schools or not and what that could look like. But I think it's absolutely essential. And one of the biggest disappointments and why the consensus report that not the consensus on 81, but the consensus
report about consolidating government.
Why it failed is because they completely dropped the idea of potentially consolidating schools. And
they stayed away from it.
Right. from it.
Yeah.
And I think when you had a community that was devastated, when you had a community that experienced Kennedy Square and several other issues, that is a good faith effort to make them believe that later on they won't be consolidated out this kind of new footprint, right? Without actually addressing the issues of schools and without addressing how and where we interact and live, when you think about the fact that a lot of suburban communities, towns and village exclude people from being able to build affordable housing developments because they don't want people in their neighborhoods. I mean, right. I think we have to own that truth. Then we're not getting at what the potentials can be for replacing the viaduct and the things that can come afterwards to create a really more unique community that, again, we're small enough where we can actually do big things, but large enough where that matters and is meaningful and can be a model for several other cities and communities across the country. And we have a chance to regenerate. And 81 is not the magic wand to solve that, but it begins to open up the promise for what that could be.
So you're saying look at it as an option to really change the face of Syracuse in many, many other ways. It's a very specific concrete one, pardon the pun.
But
it could also allow us to look at the city in many different ways.
I think it gets us to start thinking about infrastructure differently. Every piece of physical infrastructure reflects a status quo. At the time it's created, it's put in place as a reflection of our values, what's important to us. It also excludes. It reflects who is in power at the time. And the question is, what do we want the status quo for the next 50 years to look like for the city of Syracuse? And this represents a real opportunity for all of Central New York to redefine the status quo and to, you know, take it in new and different, and like Yusuf said, exciting directions.
Right.
And in fact, if we don't do that work, we're not going to be able to regenerate. And I think sometimes we need to think about what's happening globally and nationally and understand the trends about people moving back into cities and people wanting to live in robust cities. You cannot have a robust suburban community if you do not have a robust city. And if the city continues to go in the direction, I think there's a positive direction that the city is going in now and there's opportunities. But if we don't actually mitigate those issues, again, people don't send their kids, people don't move to communities because it's in the suburbs. They move to communities because they want their kids to have better opportunities, people who have children. You don't relocate a business to a city or to a community that isn't thriving. You just don't do it because your employees will have children who they may not be able to go to great schools. And so we have to begin to look at this as a necessity, not just as an option, but it is essential that we mitigate these issues so the community and the region as a whole can begin to heal as well as grow.
And nationally, I mean, we are having an regional infrastructure conversation here, but we've heard a lot about infrastructure bills and revitalizing America's infrastructure. Syracuse is doing it. So what example can we set, and how are we trying to be an example for what could be happening throughout the country over the next few years?
I think the key is if we can get it sort of the Central New York mindset about infrastructure, that it's not just about that piece of infrastructure and transportation, but about all of the ripple effects, all of the spillover effects, about the values that it reflects, we could really change the conversation and take infrastructure from being something that is boring and technical to making it into something that's really exciting and that is a locus for civic engagement, center point, for civic engagement.
Jonathan, as an urban planner background person, can we reimagine that? Is this an example? Can Syracuse be utilized, or how would you have it utilized in this decision, utilized as a way to say, hey, let's reimagine, let's be a city. We have all gone to places that were like, wow, this place is really cool. You know, whether it's because of bike paths or whether it's because of, you know, classic or new ways that they've done things with mass transit or housing or what have you. Can Syracuse be one of those?
Absolutely. I think.
And how do we make that happen? Who leads that?
I think that we all have to lead that. I think it's important that, you know, we're all a part of that process, and it's not driven by, certain special interest groups that, you know, steal the microphone. I think that, you know, what we're seeing now is an opportunity, and especially with the growing conversation in our community about this particular piece of infrastructure, that we're starting to see that. That broader vision of this is something more than just a highway, that this is something that can you know, inspire people and attract people to Syracuse like they are seeing in other communities, and create an opportunity for a 22nd century piece of infrastructure rather than something that was from the past.
Yeah, I think Jonathan hit it at the nail by thinking about the future. We're going into a future that's rapidly changing, mm-hmm. and it's currently rapidly changing. We're talking about autonomous driving, driverless vehicles. We're talking about, you know, the Internet of Things. And we want to go back to a time where the car is the center of the world. I mean, that's not the future thinking.
Will the car always be primary?
Will it even be something that we continue to drive in the ways that we're not driving in the ways that we have historically? And I think it's important for us to think about, why is it that we view public transportation in Syracuse and in Onondaga County as a class issue, right? You can be a billionaire in New York City. Michael Bloomberg took the subway.
Going to other cities, you were mentioning you were just in Mexico City. Yeah. I'm not sure what their mass transit is, but many other cities you go to, you just consider mass transit. You'd rather not drive.
Yeah.
And it works, and it's efficient, and it's just part of the milieu.
And Mexico City has a challenge because they've got a lot of vehicular transportation, which causes traffic and accumulation of fumes, et cetera. But what I found was interesting and what I thought was valuable for Mexico City and as a lesson that we can learn from in Syracuse is the ways in which they engaged plazas and platforms to create spaces for people to connect.
Mm-hmm.
That don't exist here. There aren't walking trails or central parks, if you will, where you on one side still have your traffic, but in the center of that are paths where you can walk. I'm thinking about Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn or mm-hmm. other places in other cities where there's a sense of vibrancy in those areas,
right,
because of those spaces that people can come to connect. And this is a chance for us to create that. Syracuse has a chance to be a world-class city. I don't mean that hyperbolically. I've lived in many countries. I've probably been to 12 or so countries around the world. And every time I'm like, Syracuse, the only missing ingredient is this damn highway, right? Like, and so like, I'm being facetious to make a point, but we can be a world-class city. We have all of the ingredients. We have the universities, we have the medical centers, we have a proud history, a beautiful history, and we have a chance to really make ourselves come out of an age that we should be engaging this conversation to be centered around. But if we don't address these racial inequities, if we don't address the economic injustice, and if we don't address the ways in which we limit our capacity to think and imagine because it is a viaduct, we will not be able to get to that future.
All righty. Well, I think that's an excellent place to wrap things up. I want to thank Yusuf Abdul-Qadir from the Central New York chapter of the NYCLU, Jonathan Link Logan from the Northside Up program at Center State CEO, and Dr. Ann Mosher, a chair of the Maxwell Citizenship and Civic Engagement Program. This has been CNY Speaks, the new public affairs program from WAER, connecting you to the issues that matter here in Central New York. A reminder that we have covered a number of the issues discussed in this program on our City Limits project. That was our project examining poverty in Syracuse. You can see that reporting at citylimitsproject.org. And we'll continue to be covering the I-81 community debate over the decision process. So stick with us on both WAER 88.3 and on WAER.org. And finally, you can hear the discussion again if you'd like. The entire program will be on demand on our website at waer.org. For WAER's Katie Zilkowski, I'm Chris Bolt, WAER News.